everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail. This is the podcast where you control the conversation right here at the critically acclaimed network. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. And for the purposes of this podcast, you can call me Rockmeister McCool.
And I highly recommend you take advantage of it. This is your only chance.
This is the podcast. Nobody calls me Rockmeister McCool on any other podcast.
If you see him in a crowd and you yell out Rockmeister McCool, he will not answer to it. Unless you preface it with, "Dear Bibbs and Rockmeister McCool, thank you for answering my letter." And everyone's looking around you real weird. Because you just started yelling that in the crowd. Also, why are you in a crowd? It's a pandemic.
This is projecting forward when crowds can gather once again.
Anyway, I'm feeling weird tonight. This is our letters show. You write into us. The email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. And we answer your questions. We respond to your criticisms. Mm-hmm. We take your requests. We'll basically talk about just about anything you want. This time is yours. You listen to us talk a lot. And so we want to give everyone else an opportunity to take this platform. Mm-hmm. And we don't like to dilly-dally. Whitney, why don't we just jump right in?
This is a letter from Mrs. B.
Hi.
Hello, Mrs. B. Dear Messrs. Bibbiani and McCool, I've been listening to your podcast for about a year now after getting to know you from your appearances on the Schmodown. While I haven't seen many of the movies you discuss, I'm enjoying listening to a couple of good friends sitting around and talking about their shared interests. Mm-hmm. As I am not too much older than Whitney, sometimes our nostalgic interests overlap a bit as well. That's always magical, isn't it? When somebody mentions something and you get it, like the nostalgia
It can be a really narrow window right now. Like, you have to be born like within like a year of someone now. Otherwise, I just didn't see Don Coyote when it was a cartoon on TV. It was only on this one narrow window.
And as we've said before, you and I are 4 years apart in age.
Yeah.
But which is technically we're like different generations. So we do come at things pretty differently. This is taking us to task for something, so let me continue. As I was listening one day, I noticed that you suggested a movie, I can't remember which one, was okay and a good movie to watch with Grandma, implying that Grandma would prefer a gentler, simpler movie. That was the movie The Dig I was talking about.
Oh, okay, so this is all on you. Great, awesome. Yeah. I feel so much better, I'm not gonna lie.
Uh-huh. We'll discuss your mistakes soon enough.
No.
You have done this more than once, but you are not alone. I've noticed that music is handled in the same way, as in don't listen to this with Grandma in the room. We are also shocked when we hear on the news that a woman was arrested and that she was a grandmother. I'm not saying that, quote, Grandma was young once too. Rather, do we really think that a drastic personality shift happens upon becoming a grandparent?
Yeah.
Or that we are so very different in our personalities than those who came before? Or that we are more savvy or erudite or jaded or whatever? My parents, these days known as Granny and Papa, introduced me to Twin Peaks. Mom and I saw Fire Walk With Me together, the original Little Shop of Horrors, Alice Cooper, and Catcher in the Rye. They still like those types of things. Their preferences haven't changed. They didn't suddenly become Celine Dion fans. And they still like movies with a Lynchian vibe. Anyway, this is starting to turn into a rant instead of a question, so let me think of a question. Have you noticed this habit as well? Do you recognize when you do it to yourself? Why do you think we categorize older generations this way? Okay, glad I got that off my chest. Hope that all made sense. My best wishes to you and yours, Mrs. B.
You know, this actually is a really good point, and it's something that I think there are certain conversational rhythms that we fall into very, very easily because they were, and there's no pun intended here, grandfathered or grandmothered in. This is how our parents referred to their grandparents. This is how we thought of our grandparents, and for many years it was considered that, oh, they were from a more conservative time.
Yeah.
And they didn't like things like the Beatles. My grandparents hated the Beatles. They didn't understand what the premise of the Beatles was. They threw out my mom's Beatles lunchbox. Could have put me through college. So there's definitely that vibe. There's definitely that vibe. Yeah. However, that's our grandparents, or at very least mine.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily anyone else's. There's a comedian who's been in a lot of bad movies, but I've enjoyed some of his stand-up, Nick Swardson.
Okay, yeah. I know Nick Swardson.
He had a bit. I don't like all of his stand-up. But he had one good bit where he was talking about this exact phenomenon, where we're so used to thinking of our grandparents as listening to, like, old-timey music from the 1930s, but everyone gets old, and there's soon enough there will be grandparents who grew up listening to NWA, and they're going to have a totally different vibe as grandparents. So, Mike, you're right. It's probably time to retire this.
Well, will it? Because as new generations come up and their interests start to take the place of the grandparents' interest, so the way you just approached that is as somebody who is clinging on to their dominance in the show business marketplace, people are still catering to people your age, William. But you're going to age out.
Well, exactly.
And your interests won't be mainstream. And so no matter how
hardcore...
But that
doesn't mean they're going to be mild or milquetoast, is my point.
But they will be. Here's my point. You'll be listening to NWA, and that is going to seem quaint compared to the new stuff that will come up.
I see your point.
Listen to, listen to the way your parents or your grandparents talk about Elvis Presley and how revolutionary he was. You listen to it today, and you might have a question mark. What? This was the thing that was shaking everybody up.
That's why it's important to contextualize.
Exactly.
That's
what
we do.
But, you know, you listen to a lot of, rock and roll from the 1950s, and it seems so serene and kind of peaceful now.
Yeah.
And there's a article after article have been written about the fact about classic rock stations, about how all of the stuff that you hear on classic rock stations is typically like 1970s rock, like 1970s rock and roll.
For the most part. 80s has been creeping in there.
Well, exactly. It's been creeping in, but when I was growing up, it was all classic rock, and you listen to all of that stuff, and that used to be sort of the rebellious voice, the voice of a new generation. It's really trying to put down the generation that came before it. Mm-hmm. And as
people try to put me down,
and
talking about my generation.
Yeah. You know, I can't get no, I dare you not to bang on the side of your car. No. You grow into your 50s, you're still listening to that music because it gives you that same good feeling, gives you that nostalgic feeling.
Right.
And now it has the opposite effect, right? Now it's comfort food. It's not about being rebellious and destructive and tearing down the old structures. It's about feeling safe again.
Well, what we've got here is an example of it's all relative.
Yeah.
So the stuff that grandparents will be like in our generation when you and or I are grandparents will seem pretty daring compared to the stuff our grandparents were into. And I'm not entirely sure that's always going to be the case because I feel like tastes change and sometimes tastes get a little bit more sensitive. I've noticed this generation is a little bit less eager to just be in your face for the sake of entertainment and making a statement. Yeah, I noticed a lot more sensitivity overall in the way that we make our art.
The entertainment for the early 2000s kind of went a little overboard. So now we're
withdrawing
from
that
a bit. Yeah.
It's a cycle. It's a cycle.
And we'll push again and then we'll pull back
Clothing styles get more...
garish and then they're conservative.
Garish is a good way to put it. Yeah, exactly.
Midriffs
were everywhere 20 years ago.
Oh my God, the low-slung pants. Like, I love looking at science fiction films that were made in the 80s because they looked forward to the 90s and thought it was just going to be 80s-er.
Yeah, it's going to be more prog rock.
Bigger shoulder pads, higher mohawks. And
the newest of waves.
They could never have predicted flannel.
But it's true. So you're right. And sometimes, I will say this. I think you're right in that when we discuss things like something your grandparents can enjoy, what we're basically trying to say is it's something that's relatively inoffensive. However, grandparents might always be interested in things from previous generations, and that might always be relatively more accessible or less edgy than the new generations. But I don't think that's always going to be the case. And I do think, of course, every grandparent is different.
Indeed.
You know, my dad was a biker, and he was a granddad, you know, so.
My mother, who is also a grandmother, I've noticed her taste changing, though. When I was younger, she would point me towards stuff like Ingmar Bergman's Scum and Shame, which is an incredibly harrowing movie. And she, knew about David Lynch. And she, had listened to rough entertainments. But as she got older, and this is going to happen to all of us, and as you experience more of life, using death and edge and misery as a form of entertainment isn't as fun anymore because you've experienced a lot of that in real life.
Yeah, it starts to become not so much fodder for entertainment as something that's genuinely kind of depressing.
Yeah.
Or really something to take really seriously.
So my own mother, who used to go to art houses all the time and see, edgy fare from Ingmar Bergman and Antonioni, it now is perfectly happy to watch like detective shows on BritBox. She likes a lot gentler entertainments now.
Yeah.
I expect the same is going to happen with me.
Yeah. My parents were weird because my dad was very much of the, I can't understand what everyone in Metallica is even saying. What is this music? And then my mom was like, she had the biggest crush on Kurt Cobain. Like when Kurt Cobain died, it was a tragedy for everyone, but it hit her like even harder than it did me. She was a bigger fan than I was. So she was always kind of like, kind of more cool when in music than most people I knew from her age group. Mm. You know, but granted, I didn't talk to everyone's parents about music, but you know. So, but in any case, the generality is something that is not going to hit everybody. And maybe we need to be more specific with our language. Anyway, but thank you so much. That's a really good observation. And we need to be cognizant of these things because if we don't reconsider the words that we use every once in a while, we might lose sight of what they really mean.
Yeah. And so when,
and we don't want to seem ageist, that's for sure.
I wasn't trying to imply any kind of ageism that anybody who is a grandparent has changed tastes. When I refer to a grandma film or more frequently I refer to dad films, I'm trying to evoke a certain kind of film. And I think that's meant to be descriptive, but you know, I'm not trying to disparage a group.
Yeah, I can say something that I definitely observed with my own eyes between my dad and other people around him. Maybe less so my dad because he was always into it. But Patton Oswalt had a joke about how, you know, when like you hit 50, you develop a sudden unexplained interest in World War II.
Yeah, Greg Proops has a bit about that, too.
Yeah, it's just a thing. Like, every dad I knew, once they hit their 40s, just got more interested in World War II and started watching the History Channel more. They weren't even of that generation. They didn't go to World War II. Their dads just might have.
This
but
weird,
like,
fascinating bit of history now. They become these history buffs about war.
Yeah.
It's either that or the Civil War. That happens,
my
too.
My dad was never into the Civil War. Okay. He was never fascinated with it on, like, a tech level. My dad was, like, a rivet counter, and he knew all about tanks and formations and all these sort of strategic things, and so that was a really great letter, though. Thank you so much for that. And let's move on.
All right, here's a letter from Kaylin. Hello, Kaylin. Hello, Bibbs and Whitney. Thank you for your Hitchcock recommendations. I'm excited to have some suggestions as to where to start. I have two questions today.
Okay.
What is Sight and Sound? And why is their best films list the one y'all reference? Beyond your podcast, I have not heard of it, so I always fall back on the AFI list, which seems to differ slightly. Who comprises the voting body of each list?
Okay.
That's a great question. There's a second one here. I have lots of memories of eating Blue Bell mint chocolate chip ice cream with my parents as a child. Because of this, I still occasionally buy it and call it my favorite ice cream, even though I prefer others now. I also fell in love and became fascinated with films from watching Titanic on opening at way too young an age. Because of this, it'll forever be my question, the answer to my question, what is your favorite movie? Even though I revisit it far less than dozens of other films. So my question, what are some things that are your favorite because of nostalgia rather than because of your current taste? Caitlin. Sign Caitlin.
I'm gonna answer the second part first because it's a bit more direct and it's just a matter of I like these things. They're not good, but they're comfort. And my number one answer for this will always be SpaghettiOs. SpaghettiOs are awful. They're awful food.
They're supposed to taste like cheese, but it's been a long time since that was cheese.
They just taste like SpaghettiOs. You know how like purple candy no longer tastes like grapes? It just tastes like purple.
Yeah.
That's how I am with SpaghettiOs. SpaghettiOs tastes like SpaghettiOs. You can only use the word to define itself. It's only divisible by itself in one.
It's like chemical flavoring and a lot of sodium.
It was something that, you know, after a hard day, my parents were both educators. They're exhausted. They're as exhausted as I was at the end of the school day, if not more so. That was the thing they would give me like right away. And then we'd usually have dinner really late. So that was like our late afternoon snack was like a can of SpaghettiOs. So like that's not that I have it every day, but it was common.
Yeah.
So for me, that is comfort food. That is, I don't have any energy to do anything else. Thunk. Shunka, shunka, shunka. There's always a few left in the can. Get a spoon. Clinkety, 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 clinkety. Flunk. Put it in the microwave. 80 seconds. Oh, 80 seconds.
All right.
Never, don't overdo it because you want to eat them right away. What am I, a masochist? And then you take him out, give him a little stir, and you go, that's average. And then you go go watch Pirates of Dark Water. Like, that's my day. So that is pure nostalgia. It's not good. It's terrible. I don't recommend it. It's like smoking. I don't recommend you start, but it is something.
Spaghetti, don't go back with SpaghettiOs.
No.
Don't, because
unless you're like me and you never quite gave them up.
I didn't forswear SpaghettiOs. I just sort of outgrew them. And so I had a can, like my last can at maybe age 12. And then years passed, and in my early 20s, I decided, you know what? I miss SpaghettiOs. I haven't had them in a while. Let's see what kind of high they give me. And I went to the store and I bought two cans. And I ate a can, and it was exactly the same. The sense memory was just back, and it didn't fill me with nostalgia. It's like, well, that's the same chemical cheese I remember.
Huzzah, consistency.
A week later...
I like to think they're using the same cheese. Like the same block.
It's just this massive block they keep carving hunks off of.
It's like the movie The Stuff. It just keeps growing.
It just keeps growing back. It's this big living organism. The next week, I ate the second can of SpaghettiOs, and my body said, fuck you. That first one, I'm willing to give you a pass, but the second one, I cannot forgive. And I was so sick the rest of the day. Yeah, don't go back with SpaghettiOs.
Awesome. To answer your second question, you didn't really give a, what was your nostalgia?
Oh, well, nostalgia for a film.
Or just anything, really. What's your nostalgia for that's like, you know it's not good.
Something
like,
well.
But you have nostalgia for it and will always be good to you.
Laura Scudder's Peanut Butter.
Okay.
That was my favorite food when I was three, and it's still my favorite food now. The really oily kind that's just peanuts and salt. Mm-hmm. I wasn't raised on like the Skippy and the Jif and the homogenized peanut butters. Those were a little alien to me. Oh. So I'd go to friends' houses and they'd spread this weird sort of waxy peanut butter on their crackers. I was like, what is this?
Yeah, I can't go with where you go on this journey, I cannot follow.
No, I understand I'm unusual in this regard, but yeah, I liked the stuff that was really like the oil would separate and you have to stir it in. You have to store it in the fridge. It always weirded me out that people kept their peanut butter in a cupboard. Like, no, that needs to go in the fridge. I was so used to storing it in the fridge. I also got raw milk, and my mom my mom forbade sugary cereals in my house, so I never had like Cap'n Crunch or Trix. I had like Grape Nuts and Wheaties.
All right.
Those foods I was raised with, I like a lot.
And answer your other question, and it's something that you're right. We've talked about a lot, and it's been a long time since we've introduced anyone to it. For people who are mostly familiar with entertainment journalism from America, or maybe even only like on the internet, Sight and Sound is a British magazine that's been going on for nearly 100 years. I think it's about 90 now. It is published by the British Film Institute, which is a charitable organization that funds movies and is also big on promoting film as an art form and also preserving the heritage of cinema. They have been, for every decade since 1952, I think.
52, it was the first poll.
Yeah, I know it's on the twos. I just wasn't sure if it was 42 or 52 that they started.
It was 52.
Ever since 1952, they have been culling together a list, the most definitive list that they can. And they go further in this regard than any other list I've ever seen. Even AFI, I'll explain that in a minute. They've been trying to get the definitive list of what is considered currently to be the best movies ever made. And what they do is they put together a vast assortment. I think it's like hundreds of people now.
It's a huge amount of filmmakers and critics.
Yeah, they put together some of the most respected critics from all over the world. Not just like the people you know from the United States or maybe Britain, but like people from every country where they can find great critics. And probably they should be doing even more, but you know, they gotta, whatever. I'm not in charge of that. And they put together as many filmmakers as possible, and filmmakers like Martin Scorsese, Francis Ford Coppola, John Waters, Spike Lee, all of these people, they put together their own list, and everyone puts together a list of the top 10 films ever made. And then the Sight and Sound poll puts together one list of everybody.
A big master list, compiling all of the best.
Nothing's ranked, whatever film gets the most votes is number one. And then downward, and there are ties if necessary. There hasn't been a tie for number one that I can recall.
Not for number one, but there's ties every year.
Yeah, ties.
Or every decade.
And they'll put together like the top 200. But then, and here's what makes this... That's cool in and of itself, because what we're dealing with is people who almost uniformly really know what they're talking about, are familiar with the whole of film history, and aren't just... They're trying to avoid things like recency biases. They're really trying to give you the history of film.
There are filmmakers and critics in those lists who like to throw it for a loop. It's up to them.
Yeah.
They can choose whatever they want.
But then that's the cool thing is it's not just a popularity contest where here's the top 200 and that's that. Oh, no. The Sight and Sound poll also takes everyone's votes, and they split them up as necessary. So, for example, here's the list of all the votes together. Then they'll also provide you with a list of all the films that won strictly based on filmmakers, people who from that side of the industry. And here's a list from film critics. Slightly different list, isn't it? And then, and this is my favorite part, they have a database where you can look up everyone's top 10 list based on name. You can look up the film and look for everyone who voted for it.
And in, they have a list of every film that was voted for. And my favorite part of that is the bottom half of the list of all of the films that only got one vote. Because there are some really fascinating films. Somebody thought enough about that one film to include it on a top 10 list.
They thought, listen, I only get one chance at this. And even though I'm probably the only person who's going to vote for it, it's not going to rate. It will forever be part of the list. And as a result, you get a really interesting list. And it's not, the top 200 is usually pretty dang good. Like, it's not a lot to complain about. And then almost anything else at least gets a mention. So if you love cinema, you just dive in. If there's one particular critic or filmmaker you're super interested in, find their list, go through that list. It's super exciting. I would consider it the greatest honor in the world if you and I were both asked to participate.
There's going to be another one next year, so our time isn't up yet.
I know, right?
Well, they'll ask us.
And then we'll have another 10 years. I hope I live that long. So that's what's cool about that. The AFI is basically the BFI idea, except it's supposed to be strictly for
American films made in America. Yeah.
The BFI list is literally every movie in the world. It's got films from every country. It's got everything is eligible. The AFI Top 100 is actually kind of nationalistic. They're supposed to only be films that were made in America by Americans, or at least for American co-productions. There's a few that seem kind of nebulous.
Like British.
So like Seven Samurai isn't eligible, even though it usually ranks in the top 10 of the Sight and Sound poll for the AFI list.
And the frustrating thing about the AFI list is it's compiled differently. It's not just a poll. They don't poll American filmmakers to choose the best.
I think they do some, but I remember some people talking about it. Like, I know Spielberg. I remember hearing Spielberg voted.
Okay.
And then when he found out, like, I think the original list had, like, a bunch of Spielberg films. And Spielberg was like, hey, can you take off a couple of mine and maybe add, like, some of these other movies that you missed? And they were like, no, the votes are the votes, which is fair, but, like...
From what I understand, it's a much smaller voting body, and it's, you know, like... As such, I find a much more limiting list. And it also feels a lot more like a publicity stunt. Because I remember when they released the list and there was this big TV special and they're counting down all the movies and took 2 hours out of, you know, co-opted Star Trek that evening. And,
I love the co-opted, preempted Star Trek.
They co-opted Star Trek. Star Trek was all on there.
Yeah, the card was just like...
It's commercial now. It's bullshit.
Set phases to number 49, The African Queen, starring the great Humphrey Bogart. Just shoots DVDs of The African Queen at the Borg.
Captain, there's something on our sensors. It's Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. So the AFI list is well known here in the United States because it is a film of list of films from the United States. We cite the AFI poll just because it's so exciting to us as film enthusiasts for films around the world.
And, you mean the Sight and Sound poll? We cite the AFI poll.
Oh, sorry, I meant
we cite the Sight and Sound poll because we think that's a more interesting list.
It's a more interesting list. It seems to be a little bit more holistic. If there is a way to gauge. The broad opinion on the world of cinema, this is about as close as we can get.
Yeah.
That seems like a pretty good technique. Nothing's ever going to be
definitive,
because there can't be a definitive.
I disagree
list,
with it. Vertigo's been number one on Sight and Sound for like the last 9 years. I've disagreed with it ever since.
Well, it came in number one at the last poll, which was in.
That's my point. And that's the last poll. And then next time, maybe that'll be different. Who can say? But that's the other big difference
from 52 up until 2012. It was Citizen Kane was number one.
Nope. First one was Bicycle Thieves.
Oh, you're right. I apologize.
First one was Bicycle Thieves. You're right. Then it was Citizen Kane consistently at number one until 2012 when Vertigo overtook Citizen Kane. Somehow I doubt that'll be the case this next time, but who knows? Maybe something else will take the number one spot. The thing that I think is also really important about the Sight and Sound list, more so than the AFI list, is that Sight and Sound redoes the list consistently every 10 years. AFI did the list, then they updated it like once And it really wasn't that different. There were like maybe like
a few, 12 films. A few more recent films.
There was like 12. Yeah. They got rid of Birth of a Nation on there. Good. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a few things that got knocked off or bumped back on, some of which I agree with, some of them I don't. But it feels like the sort of thing they should be doing every 10 years. Mm-hmm. Or more often than that. Regardless, yeah. I feel like because we still, a lot of people still reference it. Mm-hmm. Oh, I've how many films in the AFI Top 100 films list have you seen? And I'm like, well, almost if not all of them at this point, but isn't it really time we revisit that list? Mm-hmm. It's been like 20 years since we first put it together. It seems like maybe we should have a new vote just to see, because I bet Gone with the Wind won't rank as highly this time.
Yeah,
I really don't. So anyway, so that's the answer to that question. Again, we'll get that Sight and Sound poll sometime in the next year, I hope. Mm-hmm. And you know my Twitter,
Sight and Sound. They're going to ask us. Yeah.
Yeah, you know how to, I know you're listening, Sight and Sound.
Okay, so just to go off on a tangent for just a brief moment. You get to make your top 10 list. Yeah. I'm sure you have a couple lists in your head.
We did an episode of a podcast like that
one. We actually did a couple, yeah, where we did a top 10 list.
Here's
and then,
what we would pick if we voted.
And then we updated that like a few years later. And I tried to do a entirely new top 10 list. Mm-hmm. Like, so now I have a top 20 just sort of floating around. But the impulse to be a little bit naughty is lurks within every critic. Right. And I'm wondering what would be like the film that only you and no other critic or filmmaker would vote for.
The film that only
what wrench would you try to throw into the monkey?
Well, balls? I've already gone on the record of what I put on there, so I don't know what only I would put on there. I know I was very adamant, I'd still stand by this, that I would put the Rocky Horror Picture Show on it, because I think it transcends cinema at this point, and you kind of have to recognize that. But I don't think I'm the only person who would vote for that. There's probably at least a handful of others. What is the only film only I would put on there? Executioners from Shaolin.
Okay.
I think it's a really landmark film in the kung fu genre. I think it's a genre that is too often overlooked all over the world. Mm. Or, if not Executioners from Shaolin, Legendary Weapons of China. I think I might want to include one of the classics.
Kung fu classic.
Yeah, because they're not just great fight movies. They are also great fight movies, but they actually have a lot going on. Mm. So, that's a topic for another time. But that might be something that I put on there that might be unlikely. I guess some people might. I don't recall seeing that on the AFI list or the Sight and Sound list before, but maybe there was, and I wouldn't be the only one. What about you?
Others might actually vote for this, but I stand very firmly by The Tingler, the William Castle film from 1960, because it's one of the best of all movies.
I don't disagree.
It reminds us the importance of the theatrical experience. Mm. And the fact that you are in a room with other people is a vital part of seeing it. Mm-hmm. And that's a difficult thing to convey when you're watching it at home on home video. Uh-huh. But I think in terms of pure showmanship, that's not something we get to discuss a lot in terms of film.
No, it's true. And I think even beyond Rocky Horror wasn't designed for that. It just happened. Tingler was designed for it.
Yeah.
Literally. Mm. So that'd be a good one. Anyway, but that's a great letter. Thank you so much. And we love being reminded of things that we haven't explained in a while, because we remember explaining things like, we explained this like 8 years ago. Yeah, a lot of people haven't
been listening to us for 8 years.
Yeah, come on. So we have to go back and explain some stuff once in a while.
Reiterate.
So if we keep saying stuff and you're just like, I'm not 100% sure what you're talking about, please ask us. Well, we'd love to talk about it. You're more than welcome to look it up yourself, obviously. But if you want us to get into it, for everybody's sake, please do. We'd be more than happy to. So
that's the Sight and Sound poll that we talk about all
the time.
Thank
you for asking.
Here's a letter from Jeremy. Hello, Jeremy.
Hi, Jeremy.
Hello, William Bibiani and Whitney Seibold. In one of your most recent We've Got Mail episodes, you had some writers ask some rather deep and important questions that led you to talk about death, the quarter-life crisis, and the like. And you finished those letters. William usually asks for something that is a little more fun. So I figured I'd ask 5 simple, fun questions that are meant to be an entertaining palate cleanser if you should need them.
Well, let's do it. I like it. I like having... life is also frivolity. Let's not forget.
The sublime and the ridiculous bear equal weight. If you care, I'll put my answers in brackets after each question.
Sure, let's do it.
Number 1. If you could be a professional Muppeteer and bring one of the cast to life flawlessly, who would you pick? I would pick Pepe the Prawn.
Oh my god, that's a great pick.
my pick is obviously Gonzo. I would 100% be Gonzo.
You love Gonzo, but let me ask you a question. Do you think you're the absolute best choice to be Gonzo, or is there another Muppet who you might actually be even better at doing, even though he's not your favorite?
He or she. Uncle Deadly.
That was my pick.
I could be Uncle Deadly.
My pick is Uncle Deadly. Or, I think it'd be an amazing Uncle Deadly.
Or Sam Eagle. It's just like the straight man.
I think it'd be a funny Sam Eagle. I think it'd be a really, really good Uncle Deadly. Otherwise, I think I'd want to be Statler and or Waldorf.
There you go.
I think it'd be good peanut gallery. I think that'd be good for me.
That could be worse. How could it be worse? There could be more of it. Number two, if you could pick to be any race from the Star Trek universe, what race would you pick? If Whitney picks the Vulcan, what would be his second choice?
Okay.
Klingon would be too exhausting. Bajoran post-Cardassian occupation post-Dominion War seems nice. Bajoran, there's a lot of baggage there. I wouldn't want to be a Vulcan, or I wouldn't want to be a Klingon because I'm not a pirate.
See, that's the thing. It's not about, like, oh, I want to, like, have the strength of a bloody... But you're actually asking yourself what culture would you like to grow up in.
Yeah.
Because Star Trek is really concerned with that. So that's actually not an easy question for me.
Well, yeah, and I wouldn't want to be Vulcan because I do understand the appeal of Vulcans to a lot of audience members. Vulcans don't have to deal with those pesky emotions for people who are, like, perhaps really socially awkward.
Yeah.
And who are a little bit baffled by human human interaction. Being emotionless takes the complication out of that. You only respond logically, and that's easy to grasp.
Yeah.
But if you're talking about what kind of culture I want to grow up in...
I think I know my answer.
Let me think for just a moment here.
You got this.
Yeah, like as fun as it would be to be a changeling, I wouldn't want to grow up in, like, the changeling lake and,
do you really want to be liquid, like, in a jar for a while?
I mean, I'm asleep. What's the difference? Yes. I may as well be liquid.
Ah, fair enough. I like the thrash. I think I get in the middle of the, covers. I don't know.
Well, you snug in a bucket.
Right, but again... I don't know.
Here's
what I would pick.
That's a rough question.
Because I'm a very emotional person, I think I'd actually like to be a Betazoid.
Oh, just never speak and read people's thoughts and emotions.
Yeah, I mean, you can speak if you wanted to. They can. But, like, you know,
they've said on the show that it's a very quiet place. There's not a lot of verbal communication.
Right, but we don't need to, do we? So, and again, they're allowed to go join the Federation and speak verbally if they want. So.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Yeah, so, so yeah, I think I would like to maybe live in my emotions and be a more healthy emotional person.
Okay.
I think that's probably my choice. Or a Tribble.
Just be a Tribble.
Yeah, why not?
I'll be a Baku, like in Insurrection. Okay. Just hang out on a farm.
That doesn't sound too bad, does it?
Like, it's a boring-ass movie, but I could live a boring-ass life. That's easy.
I don't know if I could wear that much tan. I think I'd want to... Can we dye something color for once?
Aren't there berries or something that's, like, brightly colored in this universe?
All this time. Arcade cabinet or something? What are we doing here?
You can choose a beige or brown or mother of pearl or putty. What other colors you got?
What else you got?
Question number three. Would you choose the ability to effortlessly fly at 1/4 walking speed or be able to teleport anywhere 2 times a month? Their choice is teleport.
Okay, well, the implication is teleport without complication. Like, oh, no, I'm teleported into a rock. Yeah, that kind of thing. So if that were the case, I guess I'd teleport somewhere 2 times a month.
Yeah, for sure.
That said, I've always loved the idea of, like, floating. I always thought it would be very, like, tranquil. Mm. I don't get to travel very often, so that would be nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If I could effortlessly fly at 1/4 walking speed and sleep at the same time, I'd do that.
That'd be cool.
Question number four. From the following three franchises, pick one one to be a part of the cast, one to stop and have no more movies produced, and one to remove from all history between Star Wars, Marvel, and The Fast and the Furious.
Okay, so Star Wars, Marvel, Fast and Furious. Somebody's writing it down, so I don't like... That's a lot of things all of a sudden.
When it comes to removing a film from history, I would choose just about any film just as an experiment.
Yeah. Like, I think the most interesting...
The implication being I would still have memory of its existence.
Right. But no one else would. I think the one that if you just want to see what would happen... I think the one you remove from existence is Star Wars.
Yeah, because
the entire history of cinema for the last 40 years would be completely different.
Hmm.
Like, the first couple of years, not a lot of differences, but from the 80s onward, cinema would be very, very different if we had no Star Wars. So that would be the one that I would remove, I think, also just sort of to see. And then what we're left with is Marvel and Fast and Furious, and we're looking for what one we want to you can be stop here at where it lies, and which one do you want to be in the cast of.
I'd want to. We've had enough of those Marvel shows. We're good. We can stop.
We're just
done.
That one's just gonna stop right here.
Okay.
So you want to be in the cast of Fast and Furious?
Don't even air the next WandaVision. Just stop it right here.
That's fine.
And yeah, sure. I could drive a fast car with Dom Toretto.
I could look like I drive a fast car with Dom Toretto. Like, you can put me against a green screen and I'm fine. And I agree. I actually think, as much as I love a lot of Marvel stuff, it had a really good run. So if you want to stop that shit now, that's fine. I like that of the big blockbuster franchises, Fast and Furious started small. It was a modest car chase movie.
It was a knockoff film. It was a Point Break with cars.
It was a shameless ripoff of Point Break. And it was Point Break with cars. Not a bad pitch, but it was a shameless ripoff of Point Break. And then they had a couple of movies after that, and then finally they're like, hey, we had a lot of characters in all of these sequels. Why don't we just put them all together and then turn it into the biggest action movie franchise of all time with the most multicultural cast of any blockbuster franchise? And a part of me is like, bravo.
Well done.
Yeah, good job. I mean, they're not all amazing, but holy shit. That's really cool shit.
Except for four, they're all just brazenly entertaining, those movies.
Some more so than others. Yeah. And even four isn't, like, awful. It's just confusing and badly edited. And it's all setting the stage for five, so I'm really, really willing to forgive it. But, yeah, four is probably the worst. But, yeah, I think Fast and Furious is the one I want to be a part of. That sounds like a good plan. Yeah.
They answered, be a part of Star Wars, stop Marvel, and disappear Fast and Furious.
Oh, okay. Well, a little different.
And fifth question, if you could choose one song to have composition credit for, what would you choose?
Oh, I couldn't. I couldn't take credit for something.
Please don't let this be about money. Yeah, I'd want to take credit for the one I wrote.
Yeah, exactly. That would be the thing I'd want to do. I don't know. Like, if you're thinking about, like, that movie Yesterday, where, like, you go back in time, where you go into an alternate reality where the Beatles never existed, and those songs only exist in your head, and you might as well take credit for them. I don't even know if I could do that. I would, is there anything that's like anonymous? Like, Ave Maria, written by Bibbs.
Yeah, choose something in the public domain. Take credit for that one.
There you go.
You know, I was very fond of,
He's a Jolly Good Fellow.
When I was in elementary school, they taught us, I went to a pretty hip elementary school because they were teaching us a blues song called The Blues My Naughty Sweetie Gives to Me. And that's in the public domain now. I want songwriting credit on that.
There you go.
Going back to nostalgia. If you like to read my letter, I hope you both are doing well, and give Luca a scratch behind the ear.
I will do that.
And an extra hit of catnip for me. Sincerely, Jeremy.
I don't know if he needs more energy right now. One second. Where is that little guy? Luca, buddy? Where are you at?
He's hiding.
There he is. All right.
Is that staying in the podcast?
That's staying in the podcast.
Give Luca a little scratch.
Yeah. He was very grateful. Thank you.
Here's a letter from Name Redacted. There's no name on this one. If there's nothing signed at the bottom, there's no name on the letter, and you can retain your anonymity.
If you choose.
Hello, Bibbs and Whitney. My name is Joshua.
Oh.
Okay, never mind.
Now that's staying up.
All right, fine. Got egg on my face there. My name is Joshua, and first like to say thank you so much for consistently and successfully creating new content for us all throughout this bittersweet year. I said bittersweet because even though we had this horrific pandemic and all the protests, and that I lost my grandpa in February and lost my job in the airline industry,
I would also
like to remember this year because in January I was a single man living in Miami, and now I have an amazing girlfriend and a beautiful baby girl and working at my new job in Dallas. So yeah, well, definitely a memorable year for me personally. Wow, lots of ups and downs.
That's
there.
A huge year, and I'm sorry for the stuff that sucks, but I'm really, really happy for all the things that are going well for you. That's amazing, and it's so easy to get swept up in all the negativity and all the bad things that have happened this last year. We need to remember that some really nice things can happen too. So that's great to hear. Thank you so much for that.
Snuggle that baby for me, because babies are babies. So yeah, definitely a memorable year. You guys have been there through it all for me. So thank you. And now it was hard on you guys too. So here's hoping 2021 is a relaxed and boring year.
Wouldn't that be nice? We're off to an awkward start on that level. We
collapsed over the finish line and we have to get back up. I want to send you guys my top 10, but I realized I haven't seen that many 2020 movies and there's still much more to catch up on. So instead I made a list of all the new films that I've seen for the first time this year.
Okay.
You guys recently talked about how all forms of filmed media can be referred to as a film. So my list is of movies and TV shows.
Great. That's fine.
In no particular order, here's my list. Number 10, Sharp Objects.
I still haven't seen this. We just talked about this when we did a review of Utopia. Because Sharp Objects was also done by Gillian Flynn. So we haven't seen this, but please tell us a little bit.
Number 9, Philadelphia. Okay. I'm guessing that's the Jonathan Demme movie.
Yeah.
That's a really good one.
Yeah.
Number 8, The Leftovers.
I never quite got into it. I kind of just felt like it was just kind of sad.
The Nicolas Cage movie?
No. You're thinking of Left Behind. The Leftovers was that HBO series about, like, without ever explaining it, it's like the rapture, like a certain, like 10% of humanity just disappeared all of a sudden. And it's just about everyone who's left behind and they never get any explanation and they're all just dealing with this weird trauma. It was an interesting series. I just never quite got into it, but I can see why people like it.
Number 7, Avatar, The Last Airbender.
Okay.
I like Bender. Bender's not in the show though, so that's too bad.
Number 6. We're talking about the TV show because the TV show is amazing.
Well, the movie's just called The Last Airbender.
You're correct. My apologies. So we are talking about the TV show. The TV show is amazing.
Okay. I've seen maybe 6 episodes, and it's so good. It's fine.
It gets better over time. It's it starts out good. It gets amazing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Number 6, Curb Your Enthusiasm. It's a hair too cringy for me.
It's not my style of humor.
I've watched a lot of it, and I appreciate it, but yeah, I can't like mainline that. I have to watch an episode. Yeah. Wait a couple weeks and then watch another episode.
It's this really, really bitter kind of humor. And it was rough. Actually, I was never a huge fan of Seinfeld, but I admired the way they constructed narratives in unexpected ways. Like, it was very interestingly structured show. The jokes built and sort of fell on top of each other in unexpected ways, and I admired that. But everything was just really mean a lot of the time. And there's something about Curb Your Enthusiasm that just, like, feels like all of that negativity for me. Yeah. And I know a lot of people find that really cathartic or funny or even relatable, and I get that. But for me, I just, like, you know what? I just don't want to hang out with Larry David. I just don't want to hang out with him. I don't. Doesn't seem like a fun time to me. So for me, that's a purely personal taste. I appreciate that it's a very
well-made show. A lot of people love Curb Your Enthusiasm.
I get it.
I've enjoyed bits of it, but I can't get deep into it.
I've enjoyed bits of it
do.
Too. I just can't live there. Okay. So, like, that's my thing. So I respect it, but it's not for me.
Yeah. Number 5, My Dinner with Andre. We have a podcast devoted to it. Number 4.
We got some more episodes coming up of that soon.
There we go. Number 4, I Am Not Your Negro. Documentary.
Yeah, I saw that.
James Baldwin. Number 3, Lovecraft Country. I saw a third of an episode.
I haven't gotten... I was gonna sit down with that, like, over Christmas break, because I was, like, saving it, and then I never got around to it. I need to sit down with it. It was really good.
Number 2, Cinema Paradiso. I watched it for the first time, like, 2 days ago.
I'll be watching it for the first time within the next 2 days.
All right. And number 1, Searching for Bobby Fischer, which I watched for the first time last week, which is also William's favorite movie.
It's true.
That's a great list. I appreciate that we have a different flavor of lists coming in. It's not just like best films of a certain year. It's like people having these broader experiences in this year when the movie industry was sort of thrown for a loop and now people are kind of exploring in interesting ways. And
yeah,
I love
super
that.
Exciting. I love it. Thank you so much for your letter. That was really great.
Yeah.
And thank you for keeping us abreast of what's going on in your life. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you're having an amazing life. Yeah. I'm really happy.
Here's a letter from Daniel. We get letters from many Daniels.
We do.
Dear Bibbs and Whitney, in the past couple of years, I've tried to start reading some of the major film critics, and I recently ordered and received Andrew Serres' book, The American Cinema Directors and Directions, 1929 to 1968, which I'd read was his most influential work. On reading the opening essay, a couple of passages struck me, and I thought I'd run it by you guys.
Okay.
I haven't read Andrew Serres, but I know Andrew Serres'
I'm
work.
Familiar with him, but I haven't read this book either, so...
The context of this portion of the essay is Serres talking about Cahiers du Cinéma having a, quote, policy in which films of favored directors were invariably assigned to specialists in those directors on the grounds that, quote, the best review of any film will be written by the critic who best understands the film, usually because he is most sympathetic to it. Serres then asks, why does this sound so heretical in the United States? Probably because most movie reviewers fancy themselves as magistrates of merit and paid taste consultants for the public. He writes, Walter Kerr as defining, quote, the difference between reviewing and criticism as the difference between assuming that your reader has not seen the work in question and assuming the reader has.
That part's probably pretty apt. I like that.
Yeah, yeah. Reviewing is thus a consumer report for the uninitiated. Criticism is a conversation with one's equals.
Mostly, that
might sound a little snotty, but I think that's apt.
I think when you're looking at, I think there is definitely a difference between just trying to tell people, I saw this movie, here's what I thought of it, here's the gist, maybe you'll be interested, maybe you're not. I do think there's a big difference between that and getting knee-deep into the movie and really examining and pulling apart all the detail. Yeah. And in my work, I've always tried to combine the two. The part I don't necessarily agree with is that top bit, where the person who like is an expert in a filmmaker is the person who should write about them. They're one of the people who should write.
I think every perspective has some value.
That doesn't mean they always have the right context to maybe parcel out things in the way that the filmmaker intended. But sometimes that's really interesting. Yeah.
And what the filmmaker intended might not be what the audience gets. Exactly. So what the filmmaker intends is kind of not necessary to the conversation.
I value writing about the people who write about Hitchcock, who've seen every Hitchcock movie and know everything there is to know about Hitchcock, but a fresh perspective on Hitchcock that isn't just like, oh, I don't know anything about Hitchcock and here's what I got from it. Like, no, you need to like engage with the text and really do it strong. But like, that can be really, really valuable.
He continues to go. He says, however, Saris then qualifies his position by stating that, quote, the more fastidious film publications neglect their obligations to the medium by restricting their critiques to the films and directors they like to avoid passing judgment on a film because of a lack of sympathy is an act of intellectual arrogance. Nothing should be beneath criticism or contempt. Finally, Saris argues that his hedged, quote, transcendental view disarms either or critics of auteur theory by positioning the theory as the first step rather than the last step, and a system of tentative priorities, a pattern of theory in constant flux. He notes that no critic can entirely escape responsibility of his own values. Elucidation must yield at some point to evaluation.
Yeah.
All of that is meaningless, and it's not necessarily successful. Do you guys buy the distinction Saris makes between reviewing and criticism?
That one basically.
And is his defense of the auteur theory as more of a tool for illuminating the patterns and personal artistry in a director's work than the be-all, end-all persuasive? Anyway, sorry for the many long quotes, but that whole section struck me as particularly meaty and going to the nature of criticism itself. So I hoped it might give you guys something interesting to discuss. As always, thanks for all you do, Daniel.
Well, we're still talking about... Thank you, Daniel. We're still talking about a lot of these topics on a regular basis, and I think Saris gets to some of that. And again, I haven't read Saris's book. I don't know. Maybe he might go into more detail that might cover everything I'm about to say or might completely dismiss everything I'm about to say. I don't know. So I'm not an expert here. I'm not the person who should be writing a review of Andrew Saris, according to the Cocky Age of Cinema, for example. But when it comes to auteur theory, there's a lot of different lenses through which you can look at art. If you look at it as the work of a distinct author, that might work in a medium where the author has complete control. But in a collaborative medium, it starts to fall apart really, really fast.
Yeah.
What auteur theory can be useful for is when you look at filmmakers who seem to put a distinctive stamp on their work, as opposed to many filmmakers who less so. So when you notice, for example, that all Spielberg's films seem to have daddy issues in them, because he has a lot of unresolved issues with his dad, and he's talked openly about this, that makes sense. And that seems like something that he at least is gravitates towards. So that seems to be something that that seems to find itself into his work, and it's worth exploring in that regard. Does that mean that the writers of his movies aren't also responsible for that? Does that mean that the cinematographer isn't also evoking that, or the edit? No, of course not. But it's one way of looking at it of many.
Yeah. Of the arts, and criticism is an art. Criticism itself kind of gets a bum rap a lot of the time because of where it stands in modern popular culture. It does serve as, in many ways, a consumer report.
A lot of people treat it
like a consumer report, even actual reviewers. Mm-hmm. And critics treat it like a consumer report.
Yeah, like
is this worth your money?
Well, there's so much.
Is this worth your time?
And time is more my factor than money because like no one has time to watch everything, even we don't.
Yeah.
So we're trying to make sure that you at least, you know, if there's something you never heard of, here's what we think of it. Maybe this would be worth your time or not.
That was the inspiration for Siskel and Ebert to come up with Thumbs Up and Thumbs Down.
Yeah.
In fact, it was just Gene Siskel who thought that up. You know?
Oh, I didn't know that.
Roger Ebert didn't think they should have a rating system.
Yeah, like, let's just talk about the movie
and then people can decide. And Gene Siskel said to Roger Ebert, people don't want to know our theories on French filmmakers. They just want to know whether or not they should see it. And so they came up with this really easy codified answer, thumbs up, thumbs down. And they got trapped in that box. They kind of, they liked it and they hated it at the same time because they resented its simplicity, but they also appreciated its simplicity.
And we're kind of the same way in our format for our main review podcast, Critically Acclaimed, because we like to just have a long conversation about it, good and bad. But we know that some people are interested in whether or not we're recommending it. We want to at least pay some lip service to that, but we came up with a system that is a little less binary and is also doesn't sound as definitive because we use a C minus to a C plus.
Right.
So that was conscious. Yeah.
But because no matter how great the reporting and the criticism still has that bit of consumer report about it. The perception seems to be, and A.O. Scott writes very eloquently about this in his book, Better Living Through Criticism. It seems like it's only going to be relevant as long as the film is relevant. So it's the sort of like remora that's hanging on to the belly of the shark that is the actual film.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as the shark swims away, the remora falls off and dies, and nobody cares about that.
And it makes film criticism feel kind of parasitic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it relies on other art forms, so it's not an art form unto itself. The problem is, criticism is just as permanent as the film. Sure, you might only be wanting to read a review a couple days before the movie comes out or shortly after the movie comes out, and while the film is part of the larger conversation as Madison Avenue has dictated. But I think the better critics, most critics, understand that there is a permanence to film and that there's going to be a larger conversation that's going to continue to be had.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and that goes beyond, I think, so just whether or not just a film
that,
is
that
good.
Kind of, because, yeah, well, and yeah, it's not about good or bad. It's about trying to, without broader context, figure out what this film is putting into, I'm going to say, the marketplace of ideas.
Right.
So it's more about criticism and reviewing are actually getting at the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Just one, I think, is being viewed on a longer scale. Criticism is about looking back over a broad history. It's when you do have the context.
Yes, criticism I don't think should... I mean, again, your mileage will vary and your taste will vary.
I'm jumping off of Andrew Sarris.
Yeah, we are. And we're also talking about our own take on things. And I think, Whitney, I think you'd agree with me on this. When we review a movie, we're not looking at it in a vacuum. We're not looking at it as this new thing that suddenly exists. Mm-hmm. We're looking at it against a broad history, a grand tapestry of the art. And as a result, I don't think that the criticism, at least the stuff that we're interested in, is temporary. It is in that it can be deleted at any time, but it's not intended to be temporary. It's not intended to simply just... This is one of the reasons why I am mostly done with the idea of, okay, when you review this movie, you can't talk about any details in it because we got to worry about spoilers. Mm. We got to worry about spoilers for a week. And then the rest of history will only be interested in what's actually in the movie. The surprise will be mostly gone after a bit.
Mm.
That's a very temporary amount of time that a lot of people, when they're doing these sort of first reaction type things, or if you want to call them reviews or just the consumer report part of it, they're concerned about preserving that. We will tell you if we're going to go through it. And generally speaking, if you know that if you're listening to us, we're probably going to go into more detail than other film critics. There are some things that we don't want to ruin for you because we think that that's valid or particularly relevant. But we will also tell you what happens in the movie if it's necessary to have a good discussion. But if you are only concerned about preserving this week before the movie comes out, then film criticism does feel very temporary.
Yeah.
But if you're actually having a longer conversation about how this interacts with other cinema, what's going on in the world today and in the past, and maybe even the future, then it's different. I think that there's this interesting attitude that came up in one of the quotes, or maybe something you said, we were talking about how art criticism is sometimes seen as a little parasitic because it's a reaction to art.
Mm.
However, all art is a reaction to something.
Yeah, well, I was going to say,
yeah.
Criticism is an art. Art is also criticism.
Exactly.
This is what we, when we get into notions like the anxiety of influence, how the art you're making actually is really just a reflection of the things that came before. It's not as striking or as original as you might think. And it's the word anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And also the conversation and the old drum we're constantly banging on how all art is political.
Yeah.
Because all art is a reflection of the society that's producing it.
The art you make is different than the art you would make if you lived in a completely different part of the world and a different body, you know, in a different time.
Yeah.
It would be different, no matter how many similarities it would have.
So when you say this film isn't political, what you're really saying is this film affirms things I already believe and don't think about a lot.
Yeah.
And that's a political point of view.
Mm-hmm.
It happens to be on your wavelength. It matches your own personal political point of view, but it's a political point of view.
And anyone who doesn't share that political point of view, anyone for whom this sort of baseline reading of the status quo doesn't benefit them or they're very critical of it in some way, it will be a political film.
Yeah.
So that's just because it's not political, doesn't seem political to you, A, it is, it's just reassuring. Or at least doesn't challenge any norms.
Mm.
And B, you're not the only one watching it, which is the other value of criticism, which is, and again, another reason why just experts in something shouldn't talk about it. We need a lot of different perspectives on something in order to have a particularly interesting takeaway from it. You can be the only person who sees a movie and have a reaction to it, and that's fine. When you talk to other people about it and you share your ideas, that just sort of... I don't know. It starts. It's like a shrinky dink. You know, you put a drop of water on it, and all of a sudden, oh, that's a bigger foam Tyrannosaurus.
Well, you're thinking of the little sponges that come in the capsules.
Oh, those are shrinky dinks. What am I thinking?
Shrinky dinks came on plastic sheets, and you cut them out, and you put them in the oven, and then it shrinks.
You're right. My apologies. I was just thinking of the little capsules, and you put a drop of water on them, and then boom, Stegosaurus. Yeah. So that's what I'm thinking of.
Oh, okay.
Like that's the film. You put a drop of water on it, and then boom, Stegosaurus. Put more water on it, you get a bigger Stegosaurus.
Yeah. So
I want the biggest Stegosaurus I could possibly get. I found the dumbest metaphor I could possibly have. Andrew Saris.
I know those little
capsules. My book.
Those little capsules do still exist, and I think it's fine. The film is stuffed in a little capsule. And you have to let it out. I don't know if Shrinky Dink still exists.
I don't know. I haven't seen them in a while.
I haven't done them since I was a kid. Write us in if you still use Shrinky Dinks.
Find a Shrinky Dink. We dare you.
Shrinky Dink is one of those toys like Mr. Potato Head or Etch-a-Sketch or Pez Machines. Like, they were just around and we used them for kitsch value a lot.
Did you ever see the original Christmas in Connecticut? I forget. With Barbara Stanwyck?
No. I saw Schwarzenegger's version. That's the only one I've seen.
It's not as good a film.
I've seen very few Christmas movies.
I forget if it's in the Schwarzenegger version. I don't think it is. But in the original version, Barbara Stanwyck in that movie plays like a Martha Stewart magazine columnist type, homemaker type stuff in the 1940s. And she's so popular that when she wrote an article talking about how she'd been having trouble finding a rocking chair like one her grandmother used to have in local antique stores, people were sending her rocking chairs. And she had like dozens in her basement. And they were starting to get annoying. Like, so don't send us Shrinky Dinks. That's all I'm saying. I don't think we really have that. But if you're tempted, don't send us Shrinky Dinks. However, if you find Shrinky Dinks, please let us know. Please let us know if they're still out there. We would at least like to know. Tweet us at Critic Acclaim. There you go.
All right.
Moving on.
Here's a letter from Fab. Hello, Fab.
Hi.
Hello, Bibbs and Whitney. I just finished watching the 2020 documentary The Last Blockbuster about the last Blockbuster video rental store located in Bend, Oregon.
Oh, I haven't seen that yet.
Through the interviews from actors, comedians, and various people of different walks of life, the documentary serves as a love letter to the near-defunct Blockbuster video and the ritual of going to Blockbuster on a Friday night, browsing for an hour, picking flicks to watch with families and friends.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, the passing of time has made people who came of age in the 90s miss the face-to-face experience of talking to store employees for film recommendations, of driving to a place to pick up a movie with a family, or of getting to know a date based on the section of the store they gravitated to. Like the interviewees in The Last Blockbuster, I grew up in the 90s, early 2000s, renting VHS tapes, rewinding, and sometimes paying late fees. However, I could not relate to their love of Blockbuster video.
Thank you.
Oh, God. I much preferred to rent from mom-and-pop video stores because the selection of movies was bigger, more interesting, and eclectic, especially when it came to the horror genre, my favorite at the time. Going to Blockbuster in 2004 meant being bombarded with dozens of copies of The Day After Tomorrow and Ocean's 12 and hardly anything indie or foreign. Meanwhile, a trip to Video Stage in my shabby town meant I could choose from obscure titles from the 70s and 80s to classics and many of, and from an array of horror films. It was fun to pick a movie based on the zany and creepy art on the VHS box. Thank you, Black Roses. plus, it felt good to support the small businesses and not the mega box chain. So here is me asking, back in the day, was your preference Blockbuster or the independent mom-and-pop video rental stores or both? Did you have a favorite? And have you gotten the chance to watch the last Blockbuster? If so, what are your thoughts? Great podcast, guys. I really enjoy it. Sincerely, Fab.
Thank you very much. Last question first. Have you seen the last Blockbuster?
I have not.
Okay, so I haven't either.
I saw clips of it. I saw like a preview. But
yeah, I'm aware of its existence. I just haven't sat down with it.
Blockbuster Video, I remember when they closed down, I actually wrote an article about how ambivalent that made us feel. Because the death of Blockbuster
was like the death of a parasite.
Well,
like,
it was a sad thing, but it was because of it denoted the death of something larger that took out all video stores.
Yeah.
When we were actually renting, we wanted it to die, but we wanted just that one to die.
Yeah, we wanted the mom and pop. Basically, what happened is this. You ever see the movie You've Got Mail? it's basically like that. Tom Hanks is Blockbuster, Meg Ryan is everyone else, and at the end, instead of like getting together, Tom Hanks simply killed Meg Ryan, and then something else killed Tom Hanks and killed the bookstore altogether. That's what Blockbuster was. There were a lot of mom and pop video stores, and then in the 80s, when people started getting VCRs, they were becoming affordable. However, tapes were still really expensive, so it was more common to rent them for a couple of days, like a form of library, and As stores started getting more successful, they started becoming chains. It makes sense. That's how capitalism works.
And when they first started putting out VHS, they were made with some heavy-duty materials. If you wanted to buy one, it was anywhere from $80 to $120.
Mm-hmm.
And that's late $80. That's late 80s dollars.
Yeah, so they, again, wasn't cost-effective to buy a bunch of them. However, it was easy to rent them. So you bought one, you rented it out a few times, you made your money back, everyone was happy. It became like a social thing. We recently reviewed the series High Fidelity on Hulu, which is all set in a vinyl record store today, but it feels like a vinyl record store of like the 90s. It's like a social hub. And so that was cool. You get to go out. You actually get to like put on clothes. You had to find parking. You had to put in a little effort to get something, and that made it a little bit more valuable. The downside is, yeah, the selection wasn't always great. Sometimes the selection we have with streaming is better. Convenience is awesome. A lot of people didn't have a good video store near them. I'm not decrying streaming. There's good and bad that came with both. However, over time, Blockbuster, and to a lesser extent Hollywood Video, which died first, Blockbuster took over the market, much like Starbucks took over the coffee market.
Yeah, yeah.
And well, now they're, and they were just everywhere, and the smaller places had trouble competing, and after a while, Blockbuster kind of was the only game in town in a lot of towns.
They didn't just have trouble competing.
Yeah.
Blockbuster and Barnes & Noble did this, or not Barnes & Noble, Borders did this most aggressively.
Yeah.
They would actually, this was like the most aggressive business tactic possible. They all were well-established, they had a lot of money, and they could open a lot of branches. Where would they open branches? Where do you choose to open a new branch? They would seek out the locations of mom-and-pop stores and open nearby on purpose.
Yep. The nearest Blockbuster to me, where I grew up, was on the same block as a mom-and-pop video store.
Yeah. There was a. You go to a Blockbuster, there's always going to be a better video store, like at least within two blocks of it.
Yeah.
I went to 2020 Video. It used to be on Wilshire Boulevard in Santa Monica, California.
Oh, yeah, I remember that one, yeah.
That was my local video store.
And that was also a chain. It was a local chain.
It was a local chain. And 2020 was, I think there might still be one 2020 Video over on Sepulveda. But it hung in there for a long, long time. Porn kept it alive.
Oh, if you're that's I think I know that's the one you're thinking of, that's gone.
Oh, is it the one?
To the best of my knowledge, they're all gone.
Okay, but that was, Blockbuster Video was the worst video store.
It was terrible.
They had a really crappy selection. They were always laid out in a really frustrating way. They had to lay the boxes out on shelves with the cover facing you.
Mm.
And there was always like a few inches in between one. So they weren't filling the shelves.
Yeah, they could have. They could have had a lot more product.
They could have had like four times as much as bigger mm-hmm. selection, but they didn't do that.
And they always had like fewer things on the smaller shelves because they didn't mm-hmm. want people to have to like look and bend over. Yeah. So
no,
yeah, it was awful.
There is still nostalgia for the video store experience, but I would argue that Blockbuster gave you the shittiest video store experience.
Right. My point is this. After a while, Blockbuster was the only game in town, mm-hmm. and it was the only game in town for a while. Mm-hmm. And as a result, a lot of people grew up with Blockbuster being their video store. So people miss Blockbuster because it was the best they could get. Mm. But again, it's like, hey, we had the literally, like, if you look at like the Zagat Guide or whatever the hell it is, the best burger joint in America. Mm. But then they opened a bunch of McDonald's around it, and now it's dead. And now you're nostalgic for McDonald's hamburgers, and you don't know to be nostalgic for the good hamburger that used to be there. And I'm not trying to be condescending. I just think, you know, some people grew up with Blockbuster, and some people grew up in the era before Blockbuster took everything over.
Yeah.
And it feels like Blockbuster has now took over our nostalgia for video stores, which is just extra ironic. Mm.
They won our memory as well.
Pretty much.
And they were, when Netflix was sort of moving in on their territory, they tried that for a while. I remember they had their own mail order service.
They did.
But
they actually sold with DVDs. And they still have that.
Not everyone
uses it, but they still have that.
And if they wanted to survive, they could have dumped a lot of money into a streaming service. I'm sure they would have competed with Netflix.
Maybe they would have killed each other, but by that point, the damage had been done.
Yeah, so they just didn't have the money anymore. But Blockbuster was awful. They had really bad selection. They didn't have films for adults.
No.
Not just porn. If there was something that was...
Porn would have kept them alive, but they were trying to be family-friendly.
Yeah, well, and the rumor was, and I actually don't know how true this is, but some ultra-religious, like, right-wing CEO took over and started making these decisions that they're actually going to not carry rougher movies
like NC-17.
Too sexy they wouldn't have in the store. If they were going to carry like a softcore sex flick, they always had to get like the rated version of it, which a lot of companies did anyway. They had a rated and an unrated. And most notoriously, and this is true, they censored their videos.
Yep, re-edited them. Sent weird. I remember. You ever actually seen
that? That sounds like it's like apocryphal, but it actually is confirmed.
If you can find the Blockbuster version of Showgirls, where they like CG'd in like early 2000s, last minute, whatever CG.
Oh well, that's not quite true. That was Showtime that did that.
When Showtime
wanted to broadcast that on television, they had like the floating brassieres in CG over their breasts.
Really? Okay. I thought that was the Blockbuster version.
No,
okay,
but
my bad.
But they did slice little bits of sex and violence out of their movies without consulting anybody. They just did it of their own impetus.
Yeah.
And I remember renting some cheesy horror film, and there was like such a jarring cut, like I didn't know what happened in the scene. Mm-hmm. It was like a big chunk missing.
That was why I still haven't seen Ichu Mama Tambien, because when it came out, I missed it in theaters. Mm. And then the only video store that was left available to me at the time was Blockbuster, and Blockbuster had this, we cut that shit down.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, why would I want to rent that? Mm. I wouldn't. I'm not going to. And so I actually never got back around to it. I really need to. I hear it's amazing.
So if you were really eager to see a film that was like huge in theaters and you missed it in theaters and you just wanted to catch up with a big popular movie.
Yeah.
They got you covered because they had 50 copies of that one movie.
Ocean's 12, we've got 1,200.
Yeah, your local video store might have three. And then they'd sell off the other two eventually. But Blockbuster had all of them. And because they always had this huge volume of new films, they were a good place to go scrounging.
Yeah.
Like, wait like six months to a year after a film is new, and you can pull it out of a $3.99 bin and just add it to your collection. You have to pick at those stickers that never came off of the box.
I had this great experience where as horrible as it was that these big video store chains were leaving, and which basically mostly killed the video store market. We're very lucky. We have one video store up the street from us still, and it's one of the best in the country, Cinephile.
It lives. It lives on.
Still going, even with the pandemic.
If you live in Southern California, go there.
It's so good. Great selection, knowledgeable people. It's a good system. But where was I going with this? When the Blockbusters and Hollywood Videos were closing down, I leapt into action. I'm like, oh God, that Hollywood Video over on Santa Monica Boulevard is going out of business. We are going there right now because they were selling everything.
We were shameless in that era when video stores and music stores were closing down. We were like vultures. We were just eating all the carrion.
They weren't keeping their product or selling it back to the studio. They were just selling it. It was a fire sale. Mm. And so I would go in there and I would be like, hey, they have the Criterion Collection of RoboCop, which at the time was like $250.
You could get it for $5.
You're selling it for $5? I will buy this. Mm. Thank you. I probably bought like the equivalent of like $500 worth of DVDs from this one Hollywood Video for less than $60. Like, it was incredible. I was a vulture. But that's how nature works, isn't it? Something dies and someone's got to clean off those bones. So I will do that. And I still have a significant chunk of my DVD collection. Not the biggest, but like a size, like at least like 5-10% is from stuff like that.
I feel far less guilt than I should for all the scrounging I did.
Well, again, they didn't make the industry better in a lot of ways.
No,
they made it easier for the industry to get killed off by stuff like Netflix.
Hmm.
So I don't feel a lot of guilt for getting that out of print Silence of the Lambs criterion for $3.
Yeah,
I don't feel bad at all.
Another letter?
One more and then we're done.
Okay, here's a letter from Joel. Hi, Joel.
Hi, Joel.
Oh, wait, I know Joel.
Oh.
Yeah.
Hi, Joel.
Hello, Bibbs and Whitney.
Who Whitney knows.
Yeah. Your recent episode of Holy Batman reminded me of a story you might enjoy. Between your mentions of bad improv and the Dick Clark cameo, something shook loose in my head and reminded me of a time I made a bad improv joke. Back in the 1990s, there was a revival of the short-lived game show It Takes Two from 1969.
Okay.
The revival was hosted by Dick Clark. And the premise was three pairs of contestants would try to guess numerical trivia and the results for various in-studio events. I was not a contestant, but rather I was one of the people doing a task that they were guessing the outcome. It was the old age question, how many square knots can a group of Boy Scouts tie over a commercial break?
That's an age-old question?
It's a joke.
Oh, okay.
The main segment was much cooler. They brought in the Batmobile and spoke with Adam West about it. Mm-hmm. I think they had to guess how much horsepower was under the hood. So I'm hanging out by the craft services table waiting to be called over for my tiny piece of filming, joking around with one of my friends when they bring in the Batmobile to get into the lot to get ready. I was a fan of the show even then, and while talking with my friend, I decided to make a Robin exclamation joke. But I didn't plan ahead. Oh, no.
Oh, no. What happened? What?
So what came out was, holy cookies, Batman. I was at the craft services table. It was all I could come up with. About 15 feet behind me was Adam West.
Oh, no.
Just walking into the studio for his segment.
Oh, no.
He was taken aback slightly, and he smiled, and he was really nice about it. I don't know if he could see how embarrassed I was, but I felt pretty lame.
Yeah.
It would have been better if the joke were funny. I was just afraid he thought I was making fun of him. Signed, Joel.
I'm going to say this right now. I think you were fine.
Yeah.
Adam West has probably gotten actual ribbing, like, for his career.
Mm.
Someone just, like, being surprised to see the Batmobile and, like, paraphrasing the show in a completely benign way. He might have been like, oh, okay, I don't really want to have this conversation right now, but that was nice. Thank you. That's probably the worst he was thinking.
Yeah.
What he was probably thinking was, aw, a fan.
Maybe so.
That's probably what he was thinking.
Adam West, from what I understand, was a very game fellow. Yeah. He probably ran into all kinds of awkward things.
Yeah, that's a sweet story. I like that story.
I love stories of awkward celebrity encounters, because I've had my share. I spilled soda on Helen Hunt once. I was working at a concession counter, and it was like, she was bustling around. I was like, here's your soda. And like, the lid popped off, and I spilled it on her hand. She was really pissed off.
Was she mad about you?
She was mad at me. But she wasn't in a sitcom called Mad at You. I have a dozen Faye Dunaway stories, and
who doesn't?
Who doesn't have a dozen Faye Dunaway stories who lives in Southern California? I was working in a 7-Eleven, and she came in with a weed whacker. I have a Diedrich Bader story where I ran into Diedrich Bader at one point at this big press event right when I was starting out. So I was like totally green to all of this. And I was going for, and it was this big event where you could go from table to table and like sort of see what films people were selling. It was like this film market thing.
Yeah.
And Diedrich Bader was in a project. He was hyping some project. He was handing out cards. He was talking very enthusiastically about it. And I walked up to him and I said, can you do The Searcher from Danger Theater? Because I was the fan of Danger Theater, this really short-lived anthology comedy series from 1993, which we covered on Cancel Too Soon.
Thank you.
Yeah, he played a character called The Searcher, which was an open spoof of Renegade.
Yeah.
Just this cool guy with a motorcycle, but horrible, violent things would happen to him. He's like Wile E. Coyote. I said, could you do The Searcher? And he did. He was actually very game. He said, yeah, I'm sorry. That show was canceled. Oh, no. A plane is going to crash into me. And I said, oh, my God, thank you. And I hugged him. I didn't even ask. I just sort of lunged forward, and I felt like horrible immediately. Like, I'm still hugging him, and I feel horrible. And I let go. I just said, "Thank you. You made my year." And he kind of smiled, and he handed me a card. Yeah, be sure to get my project.
Yeah.
Years later, when Twitter was a thing, I said, "I'd like to apologize 15 years later for hugging Diedrich Bader." And he says, "I remember you." That was fine. Like on Twitter, it's like, "Oh." Oh, great. Diedrich Bader remembers that, too, and he's okay with it.
Of course he is.
I'm good.
Listen. Celebrity interactions can be awkward because, if only because, especially if it's random.
Yeah.
If it's on purpose, like you're supposed to interview them or something, everyone knows we're being professional, we're going to be polite, etc. But if you meet them randomly, you never know what kind of day someone has had.
Yeah.
And I've met celebrities on good days, I've met celebrities on bad days, and I try not to be too judgmental. If they're not like super into hanging out with the fans today, which is why usually I don't say anything. Mm. Occasionally if someone really cool, I remember, who was the guy in the Prophet?
In Prophet?
Yeah. The show Prophet.
Oh,
Adrian Pazdar.
Okay.
I mean, I was working at a bookstore. Adrian Pazdar was at the bookstore, and you're not supposed to bother anyone when you're working there, but I was such a huge Prophet fan. I was like, dude, I just want to say, I know you get this all the time. You were really cool in Prophet. Thank you. And he was already in Heroes at the time, so it was probably not something he was hearing. He was probably expecting me to talk about Heroes. And he was just like, thanks, man. That was cool. And I was like, haha, that's nice. And then I told everyone, that was Adrian Pazdar. And like, people were like, is that the guy with the Dixie chick? And it turns out he was married to one of the Dixie chicks, and I didn't recognize her. And I felt rude. I felt so rude for just recognizing. I don't know. I probably thought it was funny. But, we're in this weird position where we're not celebrities, but some people might recognize us in certain situations.
Yeah.
In a movie theater back when those existed.
Like, hey, I recognize you. Somebody might want to talk to us.
I've had like three instances and just random occurrences where I ran into someone on the street who recognized me from the Schmodown.
Yeah, that's happened to me before too. Yeah.
Just walking up to a cool restaurant on Sawtell. One time I was in a Baskin Robbins and a guy who worked there was a fan. And he was just like, hey, how you doing? And you know what? It was nice.
Yeah.
They were polite. They're into the stuff that I was doing. And they were very kind. The coolest one ever, though, was when I was at South by Southwest. And I was talking to Scott Mance, actually.
Okay.
We were just having a conversation before.
Mance is a real celebrity.
He is. He's actually he's been on Access Hollywood and shit. He's actually pretty well known. I saw him on a video in the gas station once. You know, they put videos on like the gas pumps now sometimes. And he was like, Scott, Jesus, what are you doing here? You're recording. Okay. But in any case, I was just having a conversation with Scott about some movie we had just seen or were about to go see, and someone walked by and then walked back, and they recognized my voice from a podcast. That was cool. That was really neat. That was fun. So I really appreciate it. If you're nice and polite and you don't try to monopolize people's time, it's nice to have people come up to you and say they like your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's genuinely nice. Just be polite, be respectful, understand that people might have other things going on that day. You're cool. That's a really sweet Adam West story. I bet Adam West was charmed. I really do.
Yeah.
So that's it for We've Got Mail this week. Thank you, everybody, for writing in. We would love to hear from you. If you would like to write in, our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Once again, that is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We're open books. Ask us questions about movies, whatever, other things that aren't things, maybe some different things beyond that. It's your choice. Knock yourself out. I'm running out of energy. We're on Twitter @CriticAcclaim. I'm @WilliamBibiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibold.
Once again, we give a very special thank you to all of our patrons, without whom this show and all of our other shows would not be able to exist. If you want to join us over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, there's a ton of perks. You get to vote for future episodes. You get exclusive podcasts about the 1960s Batman, about Star Trek, about Disney, about the Oscars. We do commentary tracks. All of that is available there, and there's a huge back catalog already available if you sign up now, if you haven't before. And of course, head on over to Etsy.com and look up Salt Cat Soap if you want to check out the latest soap designs by M. Lopez da Silva, my wife and partner, and also the author of the horror vigilante novel Hooker. Again, Salt Cat Soap on Etsy. There's a ton of stuff on there. It's really amazing soap. Some of them are very fancy. They make great gifts. Some of them are just really nice to have around the house. We just want to make sure you know that they're there because we're making them. And I'm going to be making some for the Schmodown pretty soon, too. So we'll be announcing that. Yeah, my goal is to keep making soaps that sort of tie into our matches. So it'll be fun. Okay, so that's it. Once again, thank you, everybody, for listening. Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney.